What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hey, welcome everyone to the From the Shadows podcast. I'm your host, Shane Grove, and thanks for joining us for this episode. I want to give a quick update on Jason, the super producer, for all those loyal fans and listeners who've been following along. I actually got to speak to Jason Friday for a little bit, and now I realize everybody doesn't know the extent of what he was going through, but one of the results of him being ill was he basically lost the ability to walk. So he is going through some intensive physical therapy so he can, so he's able to do that again. And he was actually very, very kind of excited to tell me that he had walked up to the second story of his house with nothing but the with the handrail to help. So, which is, it's kind of stunning to hear a guy that I've known for years who is, you know, was one of the toughest, strongest dudes around mentally and physically, feel very blessed to just be able to walk up the steps. And he's worked very hard to get to that point. So you know, the times are tough for everybody, but when you really sit back and think about how blessed we all are, you know, just getting up every day is a blessing. And to talk and hear Jason feel blessed that he's just able to do something that we all take for granted, because in a, you know, blink of an eye, it was taken away from him, basically. So, but he told me again to tell everybody thank you for all the support and well wishes and prayers. He definitely thinks that's what's pushing him through, and he's excited. He's been listening to the episodes, and he's excited to get back on. And hopefully, in the next week or two, when we do a recording that fits with his schedule, he could jump on and at least say hi or something. So keep him in your prayers. So before we bring our guest on, I just want to remind everybody that if you have a sighting or encounter or story you want to share with me, please find us on the From the Shadows podcast Facebook page or our After the Shadows forum page, which is on Facebook, and send us a message. You can find me on Shane Grove Author Instagram or the From the Shadows podcast Instagram page and send us a message. The website, if you have sent us a message on the website, we're not sure we're getting them. Our website guy is investigating this right now. Something seems to be wrong with the contact link. So you could try it, but you know, send me a message another way and let me know if you've sent a message that way. It does not appear to be working, but our website guy, he's really getting on it, trying to figure it out so we can fix that problem. So I have a really cool guest. And if you guys, because I know a lot of our listeners have gone to some, you know, you guys go to Bigfoot conventions, Bigfoot shows, you listen to other podcasts and YouTube channels. Joining us today is Joe Perdue. He is the one of the owners of a really cool, I guess, merchandise, Bigfoot merchandising company called Wild and Weird West Virginia, which, listen, I think that goes without saying that West Virginia is wild and weird. I don't know that it needs to be in the title, but I appreciate it. And he also is one of the hosts of Wild and Weird Radio. So, Joe, welcome to the show.
What's going on, Shane? It's a pleasure to be on with you, man. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're on with us too. And I always like to poke a little fun at West Virginia, and it's all because of Bo Kennedy, the host of the Bump podcast.
Bo's a good friend of mine.
Yes, I love Bo. I love his show. He's become a good friend of mine too, and I think he just has a sixth sense that every time I poke at West Virginia, he feels it. So any chance I get to do that, I you know, but it's all in fun. West Virginia is a beautiful, beautiful state, and but man, it's got some crazy, crazy stories come out of West Virginia.
So, oh, absolutely.
So Joe, let's get in and share with the listeners your, you know, before we get into the cool stuff you do today with the Wild and Weird West Virginia stuff, let's kind of get into your story on how you even got into the whole Bigfoot thing.
Sure. Yeah. So, I had what the BFRO would consider a Class A sighting. Now I'm going to paint the picture for your listeners so that way they can kind of visualize the environment. And that way I don't have to cut back and forth in the story, because sometimes when I'm telling the story, it can get kind of choppy because I'm trying to describe the layout of the land. So in Appalachia, when they do clear cutting, if any of your listeners are from the Pacific Northwest, it's very similar to the timbering there is how they do it here. They only timber about a quarter of the mountain at a time. So that way they don't have to deal with landslides and erosions as much. So there was a section of this mountain that had been clear cut, and I lived on the other side of the next mountain over. So this clear cut had become a favorite hunting spot for me over the years when I was growing up, and I'd frequented the area literally multiple times a year, sometimes multiple times a week, because, you know, I grew up out in rural West Virginia, and there's not a whole lot to do. So if you're not spending time out in the woods, you're sitting at home and not doing a whole lot of anything, because this was back right when the internet was new. So there wasn't a whole lot on the internet to go do at the time. This is 2001. So this area that I would go hunt, there was a massive stand of mountain laurels or rhododendron, whatever you want to call them. And I would hunker down in those and use those as a natural hunting blind. And I had full view of a couple of the terraces that were on the mountain next door. And that's where I would hunt from. I would watch. I had a clear shot. You know, it was a great little spot. Well, it was the weekend after Labor Day of 2001. And it's still squirrel season, so I've got my .22 with me. And I take my four-wheeler up to the top of the mountain. And I walk the rest of the way down, because I don't want to make too much noise going down. I want to, you know, because I like to just go in there and spot. And it's called glassing in the hunting community. And I just wanted to get down there and kind of observe and watch and see if I could just see anything going on, because there wasn't a whole lot going on that weekend. And so anyway, I parked the four-wheeler below the crest of the mountain, so that way none of the audio would really permeate down into the next valley. And I went over the ridge and started my descent down the mountain into my little hunting spot. Well, just before I made it into my hunting spot, I saw something huge. It was really, really dark. I got excited because I'm like, oh, here's a black bear. I'm going to get to watch a black bear for a little bit. That's going to be fantastic. So I make my way pretty quick into my little hunting area. I get down into the laurels, make my way in nice and quiet. I've got a really well-worn pathway into there because I used it so often. So all the leaf litter was really kind of trampled down. I wasn't stepping on fresh leaves. It was pretty muted. And so I get myself in position. I'm looking. And instantly I see this one little thing that is absolutely not a bear. Maybe around, my guesstimate is 4.5 to 5 feet tall. And it was a small, the only thing that we have, in the community as far as research and whatnot goes, is this is a young Bigfoot. Then I look just above it, right below the tree line where the living trees are still at, where they're still standing. And here is this large dark mass, and it's slapping a log. I can barely hear it. I can barely hear the impacts on the log, and it looks to be scraping at the log. My guess now is that it was, digging for grubs, because this was an old left behind tree. I look immediately to its right, and probably about 10 yards below it, there was another, what I call it, like a medium sized creature. And it was standing there and looked like it was just foraging. And it wasn't, I said standing, but it was kind of hunched over because it was just digging at the hillside. But I could see the extension of its leg, and I could see later it would just kind of hunch down and just sit where its butt wasn't quite on the ground, but it was just, on its feet, just hunkered all the way down as low as it could get and just kind of digging at the ground. Well, the little one captured my attention the most. I was fixated on it because it was actually playing like a little toddler. If anybody's ever had kids and you go to a park and you just kind of let the toddler take off, they're going to be running around acting crazy, and just jumping and carrying on. And I was enamored by this thing. Now, this whole time I had the wind to my favor. The wind was blowing to my face. I didn't smell anything off. Nothing was weird. And then suddenly the wind changes and everything I was observing completely changed very rapidly. Because the largest one closest to the tree line stood up. And when it stood up, I realized exactly how big this thing was and how small it made me seem. So I was watching it, and it kind of turned its upper body, maybe about a quarter of a turn, and it turned its head just a hair, and it raised its head like it was almost sniffing the air. But I don't know if it was sniffing the air or if it had made a, some kind of a sound that I was unable to hear, but clearly these other two creatures could hear because they responded to whatever movement, whatever audio that this thing produced, and they moved immediately to it. And once they caught up to the big one, they walked off together into the forest, and it was just as quiet and peaceful as could be. I couldn't hear hardly anything, but maybe a twig snap here or there as they moved into the tree line and then disappeared out of view. I sat there and watched them until I could not see them anymore, because the last thing I wanted to do was to draw attention to myself, because I wasn't sure what these things were going to do, but I sure didn't want to find out if they were going to be aggressive. So I waited till I couldn't see him anymore. And then, after, my butt had unclenched, I made my way to my feet and took off up the hill, got back to my four wheeler, and, went back home and just kind of sat there in disbelief of what I just experienced.
Now, how far away did you think you were for these creatures?
At first I thought that I was a little bit farther away than what I actually was. And this is where visual survey can kind of, this is the researcher in me coming out. Okay. Visual survey can kind of be difficult to judge sometimes. especially if you're with somebody who or talking to somebody who hasn't been active in a range finding skill, like say bow hunting or being a military trained sniper assist or something that that effect, where you were particularly skilled at discerning range. I thought that I was farther away. I thought that it was closer to 100 yards or so, but it was actually within 70 yards of me. Because the next year, I didn't have the gumption to get back out there that year because I was just too unnerved. And I didn't want to get out there and start looking around. And then all of a sudden these things come out of the woods at me and be like, hey, why are you here? So it took me about a year, a little bit more than a year, maybe, to go back up. And I waited until all the trees were off. So it was probably just a little over a year. I think it was the following November, that I waited till all the leaves were off the trees and I had clear view. 'Cause in September here in Appalachia, all your leaves are still on and heavy and thick. So, I made my way out to that same spot, and the big one walked by a log, and that's where I gauged everything off of this log. The log was within 70 yards of where I was, I guess you could say perched at from my little hunting area. And everything else was within that 70-yard range. And then the smallest one was actually within 40 yards of me. The one that was playing, it was the closest one to me, because I think that it was actually down messing around in the creek that was running between the mountains there at one point, and then had moved its way up. Because there was a little stream there that also kind of helps mute everything as you're moving in. So yeah, it was pretty impressive, and even more unnerving when I made it out there to actually do a measurements to see where I was at. Because the largest creature, when it walked past this stump, its knee was above the stump, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get you.
And when I went out to the stump was a good 4 or 5 inches above my knee, and I'm 6'3". So
yeah, you're, you know, I get you.
Yeah.
That's pretty big.
Yeah. I was a little, at that point I was like, oh man, this thing was bigger than what I thought, closer than what I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a trip, man. And that kind of, I set back, 'cause I had various professional, very, very professional, careers. After that, you know, I went into the military after that, and I was in the Air Force, and I was a sheet metal fabricator. And one of the last things that you're going to go do in the Air Force is talk about some weird, strange experience you had, because that will immediately get you sent to
go talk. You know, except nowadays.
The
military seems like the group, like a. Yeah, it seems like a gold mine for Bigfoot, yep. UFO, ghosts. I mean, it seems like that's where some of the best stories come from, for sure.
Yeah, you know, when I was in the Air Force, I never actually saw anything in the sky or anything. But I was on this crew that was called a Red Ball team, and what we did at that one point with this specific, because I was only on it for a short period of time, was we traveled with the specific aircraft that we were assigned to. And I was the fabricator for that aircraft for the mission it was running. And, but we never saw anything. But one of the things that was actually said, and this was a huge red flag for me, that like, 'cause I had already seen Bigfoot, right?
Yeah.
But I wasn't really big into UFOs or anything like that. I loved the X-Files. I thought it was great, but I wasn't like, oh yeah, UFOs, it's aliens, they're coming to get us or whatever. But it didn't really, I guess, cross my mind to take it serious at all, until when we were getting a debrief and they said, if you saw anything in the air, don't talk about it. You didn't see anything in the air. And I was like, the only reason people would say that is if somebody actually saw something.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same as, you know, this coffee may be too hot to drink, or
right. It's the warning labels on the Q-tips. Don't use in your ear.
Don't drink the bleach. Yeah. Why would you have to tell? Well, because somebody did. Somebody did drink the bleach. Yeah, exactly.
Somebody did. And so that I kind of put two and two together there myself. But I, like I said, I never had any weird experiences when I was in the military other than like stuff that I might have like handled or here and there. But it wasn't anything like too crazy.
It might have been classified. It just wasn't paranormal.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So then I went from there, and I was actually a minister for several years as well. I was doing that alongside of my other career that I was working in as a chef. That's another career. Because it wasn't a career. I wasn't getting paid for any of that stuff. For being a ministry, it was all volunteer work. And, it was another one of those fields where you just don't talk about that kind of topic. You don't talk about UFOs. You don't talk about Bigfoot, or, you know, it's not one of the things you do unless like somebody would come up to me. And it did happen one time. I did have one person in the congregation at one point, like they were really shook up. They had a Bigfoot encounter, and it kind of broke their paradigm. You know, everything they had thought to be true at that point had just been upended. And now there's something out there that's unexplained that they can't fathom, you know, and it's right in front of their face. So they were having some issues dealing with how to process that. So I was like, okay, I'll tell this person, hey, look, I don't think you're crazy, and here's why. And I told him the same story I just told you guys.
Well, and there's a, that to me seems a little, the religious aspect of why people wouldn't feel comfortable talking about that, because the whole basis of religion is we're believing in something that for most of us we can't really touch or see. It's nothing but faith of something that we believe is going to happen. And we're talking about a lot of paranormal things.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the Bible is full of paranormal. if the sea, you know, parted today, it'd be a paranormal experience.
Absolutely.
You know, if you heard a voice from heaven come down, I mean, that's a paranormal. That's how we would classify it today. In the Bible, they're classified as religious experiences, you know?
Yeah.
Divine intervention, so to speak. So, the Bible is probably the first paranormal case study that was ever,
you're not ever wrong.
Put into print. I mean,
you're not wrong. There were so many bizarre stories in the Bible, but the parishioners, the congregants, the believers are so focused, I guess, because there's this stigma, like you said, where it is this unseeable, untouchable God. And they're already dealing with that aspect of having to try to make that make sense to other people. Mm-hmm. That if you throw Bigfoot on top of that, then it's like, oh, okay, where's the Kool-Aid at?
I gotta be honest though. There is a lot of people that will say, and there's a lot of people that don't, you know, that don't believe in God the way Christians do. And, but if you're going to say, this is what I believe in as far as Christianity and God and stuff, but then say, well, there's no such thing as ghosts or Bigfoot or UFOs. It is kind of disingenuous.
Oh, it really is.
I agree. I mean, and I understand that some people don't believe in that, but it is almost as much a leap of faith, one compared to the other. I mean, it just basically is. And for you to say one thing is definitive and then say, well, the other stuff's just craziness, people are going to look at you like, well, that don't believe and say, well, do you realize how crazy your religion sounds to me?
Right.
You know? Before everybody out there is going, oh my God, he doesn't believe in God. No, I do. I just understand there's two points of view Well,
right.
There's absolutely more than one point of view. And if you just think your view is absolute and do not consider anybody else's point of view, well, guess what? That's how we get into a lot of the trouble we get into today in the world.
Yep. You're exactly right. And, when we started Wild and Weird West Virginia, there was some flack that I was catching from people within the church. And like, I'm no longer an active minister. We haven't been anywhere for a few years. I kind of stepped away from a lot of the stuff just because I didn't like the direction I saw things going in with different organizations. Mm-hmm. But I was catching flack when we first started Wild and Weird, because they were like, well, you're out here doing all this stuff and talking to all these different people, and you should be teaching them about God and telling about this, cause you've got the education to do it, and you should have been doing this, that, and the other. And I'm like, guys, do you not realize that these people are experiencing something that they can't explain already? And they believe something paranormal, something supernatural is occurring in their life. If they don't believe in God, do you realize how close they could be to believing in God? And that I could use this as some form of leverage to be like, look, here's how you're going to get rid of this. Here's how you can stop this. Here's how you can deal with this, and kind of use my ministerial background as a way to help them cope with what they're experiencing. And then they just kind of look at me like, oh, well, I never thought of it that way.
No. back to your sighting, because I'm not a hunter at all. I don't spend a lot of time out doing that sort of, I mean, I don't spend any time out doing that. So when I hear distances, the way I relate to it is being a former college football player and coaching basketball now and stuff, that's how I measure distances. Okay, well, that's a football field. Yep. So if I'm standing on one end zone, how far is 70 yards? And like, I'm looking out the window now as I'm talking to you out of our office, and I'm looking down a fence row. I can't tell how I've lost that ability to. Because I used to be able to run. I used to run track and do 100 meters. I look at that distance now, thinking, "Well, I would die about 30 meters." So it doesn't, it's like, man, how far is that? That seems like a mile now, 100 yards.
The way I measured everything was actually using a field tape that we had. So I measured ground distance.
Okay. Okay.
So I was on two mountains, or on one mountain, they were on another mountain. And so, unlike looking at a flat plane, we now have to bend this thing upward into a V shape. So there were 75 yards likely between, there were actual 70 yards between me and the stump. Right.
Yeah.
There was less than that when you take into consideration that the ground is folded vertically in that area. So as far as airspace between me and these things, it was a lot tighter. These were shots that I would have felt very comfortable taking a shot with a bow with, like say if it was a deer. The one that was hunched down digging at the ground was actually digging at an area where I'd had a mineral block at. And that was that was well within my range of striking a kill shot with an arrow.
Now, do you believe at any time they saw you, or they only knew you were there because they smelled you?
I think if the little one saw me or caught wind of me or something before, that it just didn't care. But the other two, they had their backs to me. All I saw was, big broad shoulders, big back ends of things. I didn't see a frontal view of those. I only saw the front of the little guy. And
what did the front of the little one, what does its face look like to you?
It looked more human than anything. There was a dense coat of hair. It had, the arms were long. This being a younger specimen, younger creature, was a little bit on the lankier side. So it had longer gangly arms. down around to where its knees would be, or just below even. From the waist up made the majority of its height, and the waist down, the legs were actually kind of shorter, if that makes sense. Like, it was disproportionate in what you would think. Like, if you were to look at, say, the creatures in Planet of the Apes, the way they're very human proportionate.
Okay.
This thing was not that way. The arms were longer than our arms would have been. The distance between the ankle and the shin was weird. Like, it's the lower extremities and lower body of this little guy just were weird. And as I look back at it more and more and more, just bizarre body structure. Almost like it was designed, at least in its young age, to move mostly using all fours, or to be able to transition between all fours and two legs at any given moment. And when it was playing, it was doing that. Like, it was running around and it was using its arms to grab stuff and pull, and it was jumping around and doing things. It actually did a couple cartwheels at one point. Like, they weren't perfect cartwheels, you know. It's not like watching a gymnast, but it was on its hands and its feet were in the air doing, like, just kind of a little rolling around, goofing off kind of thing.
Wow. And I mean, and that seems to be kind of a common description from eyewitnesses about their lower legs, that maybe, like, they're where our knees would be are a little bit lower, right?
Yeah.
Like whether it gives them an advantage of maybe walking up hill or something like that, or down. I'm not adverse in kinesiology to the point where I can tell you what the advantage will, but there's got to be something to it, you know, why
right.
that's how they are.
Right. It's that is something that we get a lot in reports. Cause as I mentioned earlier, I'm now an investigator. We take reports from all over the state of West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky. And a lot of the reports, when you have good visual survey of the body, will give you those bizarre anatomical arrangements. So it's also one of those things where, as a investigator, when I hear certain stories, I'm instantly intrigued or instantly turned off because I've seen one. And I know what at least the ones around here look like. And when I hear descriptions that are very similar, then I'm kind of like, okay, yeah, tell me more. And then when I hear some descriptions that are just wildly off, I'm just kind of like, all right, we're going to add this to the data pool, but keep talking.
So you think that from your experience and your research, that they're definitely look a certain way in a certain area then?
Yeah. So everybody always looks at Patty. You got the PG film, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can't use one specimen as a catch-all. Patty was kind of close to what the second one looked like, but the proportions were a little bit off. But that's going to be something you're going to see in individuals. You'll see minor individual differences. Like, I'm built differently than you are, and we're both built differently than the guy walking down the street right now. So there, you will see differences in physiology per individual, and you might even see them regionally. You know, if you go down into Florida, I was stationed in Florida for a while, and some of the reports that come out of there, it's like a lot more Pongan. And by Pongan, I mean like orangutan. Their arms are almost like comically long in relation to their lower extremities. And you also have longer hair and normally a foul odor, but the foul odor kind of goes hand in hand with the longer hair and living in a very humid environment, and also swamp and environments. You're going to be cruising through nitrate beds. That stuff's going to get stuck in your fur, and you know, you're going to smell like death. So Yeah, there, I think that there are different variations. I don't feel comfortable. I know everybody's probably seen those type one, type two, type threes analyses on Facebook and somewhere floating around online if you're on any of the forums. But I don't know how tightly I subscribe to that. But I do, because once you start really getting too broad, you're almost delving into like, if you have too many variations, you're now looking at like a subspecies. And I don't think that's what we're dealing with. I don't think we have, and this is just me, and my opinion can be like, you know, an armpit or a butthole. Everybody's got one, and most of them stink. But I don't think we're dealing with some form of subspecies as much as we are just local variations and just adaptive variations to live in their particular environment. Because the ones down south are also normally much shorter in description than some of the ones up north. So you've got that kind of adaptive changes that occur in their physiology.
Yeah, and in to go along with that, if the judge has said quite a few times on here that sometimes eyewitness testimony is not always accurate, even though we believe it to, you know, we believe it to be,
and
you,
right.
You know, it changes in your mind a little bit, even right after you see it,
yes.
You know, cause you start like trying to put it into something that you can rationalize.
Exactly. Our minds are very fragile things. I actually submitted and wrote an article back in 2016, I believe, to a paranormal website, and it was called Malleable Memory. And basically it detailed the importance of writing down what you saw as close to immediately after you saw it as you can. Because every recall you have of this memory is a recall of the memory, not a recall of the event. You're remembering the memory. You're not remembering the actual events that took place. So my encounter, I actually wrote it down, the day I made it home. Cause I kept a journal religiously for probably the 2.5 decades. And, now I'm not as active in it. I'm more of a nature journaling kind of guy. Like I go out and make observations and I note those and jot those down, but I'm not writing down my, you know, thoughts or day-to-day activities, anything like that. So I came back and I wrote down this report and, you know, that's why I can recite it as clearly as I can is because I've got it written, you know, and cataloged, and it was fresh. And if I sit back and I start to remember and recall this event, I can catch my brain trying to trick myself into saying something that is not canon, so to speak. It wasn't actually part of the story. So I always reference the story and go directly from it. Because that's the earliest detailing. But our memories are so fallible. It's witness testimony is fallible sometimes because the longer amount of span of time that is taking place between point A and point B, you are now recalling that memory and it's being pushed through all of your life experiences to that point. So you're filtering that memory and you're remembering it the fondest way you can, or the most reduced trauma that you experienced. You know, you're not remembering it at its full extent. Our brain does that in a way to protect us sometimes as well. So,
absolutely. I was a lot better looking and a lot more popular with the girls in high school now, 30 years later,
right?
As I remember back, than what I actually ever was. So, yes, I do. Yep, exactly. Yeah. And it's not anybody, you know, it's not anybody trying to deceive anybody. It's just, that's just a natural human, event that takes place with inside, you know, you just kind of
You can't help it. It's going to happen. If you didn't write it down, you might as well just chalk it up to a good story.
So speaking of good stories, what So now that you're more invested in going out and doing some research and following up on other people's stories, what are some of the best cases that you've received and gone out and kind of followed up on that you're just like, wow, this is something that is really, really impressive?
There's two of them that come to mind instantly. One of them was actually featured on Finding Bigfoot's revival episode that they did. Okay. And that was the John Tenney encounter. He is a amateur herpetologist. He goes out and he does salamander surveys and monitors the migration routes of the salamanders in the early spring. And normally, you know, when I say early spring, I'm talking like March, April timeframe, because that's when a lot of your salamanders are starting to get moving. And I'm a master naturalist, so I'm normally out there doing the same thing. I'm a certified master naturalist. I teach classes for the DNR, so I have a broad outdoors skill set. And so John knew all this stuff, and John knew us for several years from a past career that I'd been a part of. And so he reached out immediately because he knew that I was interested in Bigfoot. And he sent the report, and essentially he was out and he was going to a vernal pool. And a vernal pool is a big collecting pool of water. They're seasonal. They're not going to last all year round. It's just a big pool where the water table is high in that area. And so all the snow melt and all the rain will accumulate in that one pool, and salamanders and frogs and turtles and all that will go crazy in those things. Well, these vernal pools are the exact locations where these salamanders go to breed. So he was going to count and do his numbers and species counts as well. And he pulled up to one vernal pool, collected a good bit of data. And he was like, all right, I'm moving to the next one. I'm going to go up and see if I can see any other species up there tonight. And within just a couple minutes of pulling in, he had made it. He saw a toad, and he was taking pictures of a female toad. And as he was taking the pictures of the toad, the flash went off, and he heard this just massive growl grunt kind of sound that came from just beyond the tree line on the other side of this vernal pool that he was at. And he stood up and was kind of shook by it. And then he heard something moving towards him. And then he made himself scarce and took the additional six steps back to his car that he had just left. And he had a passenger with him as well. And this thing yelled at him so loud that it actually vibrated the windows in his car. And the witness, now it wasn't a visual sighting. This is pure auditory. They're only experiencing the sound because they're out there like dark 30. That's when all the fun stuff happens with the salamanders and all your amphibians. So he gets a hold of me immediately after. I make it out there the next morning. And I start doing a survey of the area. When I was in the Air Force, I was trained in crash recovery and retrieval. So I'm really good at doing analytics on what I see on the ground. And I've also taught tracking classes and all that stuff. So I'm out here and I'm looking at the ground. I'm trying to see where this thing was moving. I see clear disturbance in the leaf litter. And it's reading almost exactly the way his report read. Cause you know, I've got it up on my phone. I'm looking at it and I'm like, okay, he was standing here. And when I was standing exactly where he was standing, I immediately looked over to the other side of the vernal pool. And I saw two really deep impressions that were going in, and they were filled with water. So the sun was hitting them and the light caught it. And I was like, yeah, this is just like perfect. I'm in love already. This site is going to be rich. So I start looking around trying to find more evidence. And we found about six impressions, two of which were castable. I made casts of those footprints. I sent those immediately off to an investigator, a local West Virginia investigator named Russ Jones. And then we sent them off to Cliff Berrickman. And then the show kind of got involved at that point, and they came out and filmed Finding Bigfoot based off this encounter. But the whole time of John's encounter, he was within 20 yards of this creature. Based off where his, where the photo was taken of him with that toad and the footprints and all that stuff started. And I tracked this thing up. I could see where it went up the mountain. It went across the creek and up the mountain, and I tried following it into the woods as deep as I could, but then just kind of lost its sign. Then another one would be a site that we call the Wineberry site. And it's really interesting because it's got historical context to it as well. This, if anybody is familiar and you've been following Bigfoot for any amount of time and you've done any digging into historical accounts, then the Polk Gap Monster in West Virginia is going to be a series of 100 plus Bigfoot encounters that you might find yourself remotely familiar with. Just because they're old historic accounts, and they were from the 50s to the 70s, and they called it the Polk Gap Monster. Well, the witness, Beth, was dealing with some stuff years prior, and she had her own personal face-to-face sighting, and we did a recreation with her, and it's all on video. You can go to our YouTube channel and actually watch everything on it as well. Because we went out and did a site investigation after her and a friend had actually recorded some Bigfoot audio. And she sent it in, and I was immediately like, yes, I need to get out there like now. Where do you live? Are you comfortable with us coming out and bringing a small team? I need to get out there and take a look because there's a chance we could find some evidence. And we went out there and we found a few very nice tracks and cast one of them because that's all the plaster I had. So I cast the best of what we could find. We also showed some folks in the video that we made of the investigation of stuff that can trick people, like a bear double step, for instance, which does look like a large humanoid foot. But if you know what you're looking at, you can evaluate it and see it's a bear. But we came back from that experience with a track cast that was 18 inches long, and just the big toe alone, the big toe came out like perfect, and it was three and a quarter inches long and 2.5 inches wide. Just the big toe.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That one was a trip. So this thing, whatever she has up there is huge. And we were actually just up there this past week, and we recovered a half of a footprint. We have a really good heel impression, and it measures in the same measurements as the original Wineberry cast. So we think it's actually the same creature because the heel width is the exact same. The middle of the foot width is the exact same. So we're fairly certain it's the same creature. We just didn't have any toes because Appalachian soil isn't the best casting material. And you get real hit or miss results depending on what kind of ground it stepped on to leave an impression.
Wow. Yeah, that's a foot that I don't want to, I don't think I could follow in those footsteps. Let's just be honest.
it was impressive. We were shocked.
Like what is the size of the rest of the stuff attached to that foot?
Oh, 100%. Off of her sighting, we evaluated because it was leaning and hiding behind a tree, and the head was at 7.5 feet.
Good grief. I mean, you know, and like I said, being a former college athlete and, you know, being around, you know, basketball and stuff, I'm not sure the average person, unless you do go to an NBA basketball game, realizes how big that is.
Oh, yeah.
How enormous that is. As
a, and in a basketball game, you're dealing with somebody who's a little bit more lean. Imagine that 7.5 foot linebacker.
Well, let's be honest, okay? For Shaquille O'Neal, while he played, to say he weighed 310 pounds was an absolute lie. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Shaq was probably closer to 400 pounds.
Okay? Yeah. Especially at his biggest, when he was in his prime and he was like just jacked.
I mean, LeBron James is not 245 pounds. Okay.
Because LeBron, right. I mean, I'm 6'2", and I am probably about 255. So LeBron James at 6'8 does not weigh 10 pounds less than me. But that's what he's listed at.
Right.
And he's, yeah, so I don't think, I think it's hard for the average person to really like grasp how big 7.5 foot and 500 or 600 pounds would really be. And, you know, it's just, it would be, it would scare you probably. If it's one thing to see a human that big, but it's another thing to see something you don't understand or shouldn't be there. Would just be shocking to the point where I could see how you couldn't move. You couldn't think of anything. That's why I think these creatures, even though some people think they're super, super dangerous, and they may be if you get them at the wrong time. This is why I think that they just don't really want to hurt us, because they could at any time.
Absolutely.
Do you really think you could have got away from two adults at, you know, 70 yards, even if it was down a hill and up a hill, if they really wanted to get you? No, probably not.
No, if they wanted to get me, and they'd have had their way with me in a heartbeat. Like why I just kind of sat there and I was just amazed. You know, these things didn't want anything to do with me. They wanted the opposite of that. They wanted to just abandon and leave me alone and get out of there. They didn't want me to know they were there.
Now, going back to that encounter, one of the things that that kind of struck me was, at any time did you think, is there any more around? Like, is there any behind me? Is there any that I can't see? Did that thought ever cross your mind, or were you just so focused on those that that you thought, okay, once they're out of sight, then I'm good and I can get out of here?
In the moment, that's what was on my mind, was that once these are out of sight, I can get out of here. In retrospect, when I was sitting in my bedroom that night and I was getting ready to go to sleep, you know, and I'm laying there in my bed, I'm sitting there thinking, man, there could have been like two or three more just beside me, and I'd have had no clue, because as quiet as they made their way into the woods, I wouldn't have had any clue if they were beside me or behind me or anywhere else watching me. I wouldn't have known. So yeah, in retrospect, that was something that has crossed my mind many times.
So now that you're out doing a lot more research and stuff, what do you like? How are you prepared? How have you prepared yourself the next time that you have, if you're fortunate enough to? Because I think it sounds like you'd like to have another.
Absolutely.
Like,
I'd love to see it again.
What would you do different this time? What would you attempt to do? Or would it just be something where you would just stand quiet and awe and absorb it? Or, you know, like, what do you think? Like, what do you think about the next encounter that you would do?
I mean, I would like to say that I would try to get a picture, but like, honestly, I was dumbstruck the first time. And I just sat there in awe. And because at the time my world was also being kind of broken, I was like, well, this is a thing now. But I don't know. I'd like to say that I would do, I'd get a picture, or that I would, you know, chase after it and try to, you know, get the best evidence that I possibly could. But at the same time, like, I would probably just be as awestruck the second time as I was the first. I mean, I think I would just be as awestruck. I'm not going to say one way or the other. I would like to think that I would do something like, you know, grab my camera or whatever, because back then, you know, cell phones weren't a thing in 2001. I mean, you could have had a cell phone, but you're wearing it on your hip in a saddlebag. And it's funny to think back on that how far advanced technology's come since then. But, you know, I would like to think I would reach into my pocket, grab my phone, and snap a couple pictures. But I don't know. It would have to happen. I'd have to know what would happen after the fact, because to be back in that scenario again would be amazing.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think everybody can try to be as prepared as they want, but until it happens, I don't think you really know, you know, what that, but I mean, hey, look, I hope that you get that chance, you know, and I think if you're going out investigating places where there's recent eyewitness sightings, I mean, that's where they are, you know?
Yeah.
So
you want to hear some weird stuff?
No, we don't like that stuff. Yeah, of course. Because I have a note. Like, I wanted to ask you. So, we're talking weird stuff. Like, what's weirder than these Bigfoot stories?
Right.
I do have a specific subject I did want to ask you about.
All right. Well, let's go there first, and then we can delve into the weird stuff if it's not tied into that in some way.
Okay. So. And I've talked about this with a couple of the guys from West Virginia and how, you know, the hollers, how remote some of those, you know, what they call the hollers are, and how some of them have very little, you know, get very little sunlight, and how something could really hide out in some of those places and not be discovered or seen. So the one subject that I really am curious about is like the Thunderbirds or the flying cryptids, like, you know, basically a pterodactyl sort of creature. Is there any stories like that you've gotten from anybody that they've seen of something flying like that in the remote part of West Virginia?
We've gotten a few, but the weird part about those stories is that when they saw them flying off, it's almost as if they vanished into the distance. So it was really weird. It was like it was almost ethereal, but it breached into this reality for a moment in time and then faded right back out.
It's almost like they were seeing maybe like a residual haunting
sort of deal. That's what it reminded you of. Like, you know, when they see these apparitions of people, and for haunting, it was very similar to that. Like, they caught this brief moment in time where they were able to see this creature. And you know, the ones that, we've had a few of them come in that were like, they gave very like Harryhausen descriptions, which, Harryhausen was a, claymation sculptor back in the day, and, was using very non-scientifically accurate dinosaurs for his sculpting because he was using what was accurate at the time and not like actual, what we know based off of science in today's world. But whenever we get these reports of some of these, because we've only had a handful. A couple of them were those Harryhausen types where it had this like spade tail behind it, which we know wasn't a real thing. So we don't treat it any different. We don't think they're making up the story. We're just like, okay, well, you saw some kind of really, really bizarre creature. But the ones that actually give a description of like a pterosaur that is scientifically accurate, especially before we have what's scientifically accurate for today, those were the ones that really were like, okay, so you saw it, you said it kind of looked like had hair, pin hair on it, and then real leathery wings. That's weird. And then a few years later, science catches up and says, oh yeah, some pterosaurs had like pin feathers and leathery wings, and are like, okay, well, how about that?
Yeah. Like, yes. Yeah. I know what you're saying. Like, how could they know when it wasn't like something they could have read in the textbook or heard another story about? Yeah. Oh yeah. I get you. Yep.
So those are really cool. Obviously
they saw something that either resembled that or it was that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it could either have been like a residual haunt, because energy is never ending. Like, you can't destroy it. So these creatures had energy at one point and they were wrapped up in a physical body. Now that physical body is gone, but the energy is still here. Who's to say it's not still in the same form or can't take the same form and appear as it once did.
And I've seen, video of what people suspect are either cats or dogs as spirits.
Yeah.
So if you got a cat or a dog as a spirit, why couldn't another animal appear as a spirit?
I swear my house is haunted by a little dog, a little yappy dog. My dog hears it. We've got a pit bull and she can hear it. We hear it in the house. It's like just random times during the day. Sometimes we'll just hear like this little dog sounds like something on the size of a Yorkshire Terrier or a Chihuahua just start going to town in the basement. And I don't have a small dog. I can't stand small dogs, if I'm being completely honest.
and that bark is
one of the reasons why.
You're talking to a mailman. My whole day is haunted by little yippy dogs. I just got to say.
Imagine that in your basement, randomly.
No, I'm sorry, I'd move. I would move. No, thank you. There's a reason why we don't have a dog. Because I just, not, and again, before everybody goes, oh my God, he hates dogs. Yeah, I do hate. No, I do like dogs. Just, I don't want to own one. So there you go.
Because you get to deal with them enough and leave them with their owners through the day.
That's right. It's perfect. It's a perfect way to, have an interaction with a dog. That would be somebody else's. So hit us with some weird stuff. What's some really weird stuff?
So, a lot of people in the Bigfoot community are they're flesh and blood, right? Or apers. That's also a term for them. And then you've got people in the community who are like all about the woo. And I don't like using the term woo because it feels kind of derogatory. And it's almost as condescending when people use it. But that's just the best category we have for it, at least for a descriptor at the moment, until they can come up with something better. I experienced something that was very much flesh and blood, right?
Yep.
We have also gotten reports that we have gone out on, and Ron, my business partner and research partner, he is a 30-year veteran in the UFO research field. So he's been doing this for a long time. And he's good friends with Stan Gordon. And so am I. And basically, we've gone out on some reports where they experienced audio phenomena or had a visual sighting. And we've been in an area. And Ron, much to my chagrin starting out, now I'm like, yeah, okay, data is data, and the data doesn't care what we think about it. Ron brings out these instruments, and he'll bring a Mel meter, a tri-field meter, and a Geiger counter, and all this other stuff to a Bigfoot report. And three occasions, now we've had all this equipment with us for multiple investigations. And of these investigations, three of them, we've actually gotten very, very strange readings. Like the EMF meter will start going bonkers. Radio will go out. The last one that we went out on, we actually started getting background radiation. So, or not background, it was residual radiation. So background radiation in West Virginia, like as a baseline, fluctuates between 14 and 22. That's just what our radiation level sets at a normal day. Now, for you to establish that, you can just go to like the USGS and look up your specific region, and you should be able to actually find like what your background radiation level is, because our planet emits radiation. We're constantly being bombarded with solar radiation, so it's not unusual. So when you hear me talking about that, don't freak out like, oh no, we got radiation exposure. It's nothing fatal yet. So we're out there, and we have this we hear this mouth click, right? We hear this like kind of sound, and but it was really loud, and I was like, Ron, you hear that? We actually got it on audio, and because we had our H5 running, and it captured the audio pretty good. And then all of a sudden, Ron like fires up the Geiger counter, gets it going, and we get a base reading. We sit there for probably about half an hour, and all of a sudden the wind starts blowing. We start getting these clicking and mouth clacks again, and it kind of sounds like something's up above us on the ridge and on both sides, like we're surrounded at this point, and we're just kind of like, well, crap, now what? And all of a sudden the Geiger counter starts throwing readings of anywhere between 36 and 42. So double what our baseline was. And we're like, what do we do with this? So, you know, we obviously we catalog the data, but why would radiation start going up in an area that had a Bigfoot sighting and we are experiencing what some would refer to as Bigfoot activity? And now we're getting radiation spikes at the same time. As soon as the mouth clicks stopped, the wind quit blowing and the radiation dropped back to baseline. And we didn't get any other activity the rest of the time we sat there. So I had to reshape my paradigm a few years ago whenever the first instance we had with this took place. Because we had a Bigfoot sighting and we went to the sighting report area. We actually found footprints and the footprints were extremely radioactive and the footprints seemed to just disappear. They didn't, there were no trails leading off anywhere. I just saw footprints in this one immediate area and then there were no footprints surrounding that area. This was the only location that this creature was sighted in. It wasn't seen walking through the area. It was seen standing in the area and then it wasn't there. Like they just thought it took off, but there was nowhere it took off to, but the footprints were radioactive. The whole area within a 10-foot radius of where all of these foot shuffling took place was radioactive and it carried a residual radiation point of like 36 to 38 when our background in that area was 12. What do you do with that information when you're stuck in your head for a while of being like, well, yeah, this is an undiscovered primate. Now I'm getting all of this data that goes along with it. But what I witnessed personally was a flesh and blood creature. It was doing very flesh and blood things. It wasn't doing anything weird. So I'm left in the conclusion that there is more than one thing occurring out there in the woods. You know, you've heard of these reports with orbs, right?
Yep.
And then you have Bigfoot activity shortly after or around. Mm-hmm. Are they related? Are the orbs what's causing the radiation spike? And we just couldn't see it because we were there during the day.
Well, having talked with some researchers out from the Skinwalker Ranch, okay, and the one gentleman's like, look, there has been seen what for lack of a better term, a portal where they have seen creatures, not Bigfoot, but other creatures step through what appears to be this window to another, for how we would describe another dimension, okay. So, you know, what if the energy that it would take to open that up for maybe Bigfoot or whatever creature that you were attributing the Bigfoot activity to, what if that's the radiation? Like, that's the energy that is taking for that portal to open up for that creature that we're calling Bigfoot to be able to say, oh my God, here comes some people. I got to get out of here. I got to disappear.
Yeah, you know? No, I mean, that's plausible.
Or come back into this world. Or if you want to go UFO, interdimensional UFO type thing. I mean, there's got to be, like we're talking about the energy. And so how is that energy produced for the, and I'm using air quotes, vehicle that something is using to travel back and forth between, let's say, dimensions, or like to open up that portal. I mean, it would take an enormous amount of energy to do that. I think they've already established that.
Right.
To just open up what a tiny pinhole in, like over in France at the
when they made the warp bubble by accident.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So imagine if somebody had, you know, if another civilization or another intelligent beings have discovered how to do that more efficiently with less energy, but still it take energy nonetheless. I mean, maybe that's what's, I mean, I have no idea, but I have a,
that makes,
I have a
great imagination. I mean, that's the same vein of thought that we're in too. I mean, we're this vehicle of transportation, vehicle of appearance, not necessarily vehicle physical, but the mode that it takes to make these things happen, it very well could cause that. Like if you start looking in, you know, you mentioned they weren't Bigfoot, but they were creatures. Mm-hmm. If you start combing through Stan Gordon's evidence, where there was this, you know, couple year time frame where there was so many UFO and Bigfoot sightings that were taking place like right on top of each other or at the same time, when you look at the physical descriptions of these Bigfoot in air quotes, they weren't what you expect Bigfoot to look like. I think it was just the only term they had, because you know, the 1967 footage with Patterson-Gimlin, that was fresh in their mind. Everybody had kind of seen that and they're like, oh well, here's this weird hairy creature. But when you listen to the description, like the arms were dragging the ground, their eyes were glowing of their own volition. They could move by like hovering. None of that measures up to like a flesh and blood Bigfoot sighting. This looks at something completely different, something that's totally unrelated. But because we don't have a name for it, because we don't have a specific category just for it, it gets lumped into Bigfoot or ufology, one or the other, when I'm not 100% convinced that it has anything to do with either.
No, and it's hard. I mean, let's be honest. It's hard enough to wrap your head around that there's a Bigfoot-type creature, let alone right. Let's start thinking about, well, there's a dogman, and there's a Wendigo, and there's a Skinwalker, and there's maybe a Jersey Devil, and there's maybe all these other type of creatures that have been reported and have eyewitnesses, you know. But as hard as it is to wrap our head around, the government's also come out and said, okay, yeah, we do have UFOs,
right?
After how long? Yeah, in like you yourself said, even though they didn't come out and say, well, if you saw a UFO, okay, don't say anything. I mean, what else were you gonna see that was unusual? Like, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, while you're out there doing exercises and stuff. I mean, so every time somebody thinks something's impossible, you know, then we keep finding evidence that it is possible. I mean, and look, there's no, like, telling you if it's possible. You saw it.
Right.
Okay? You were right there. You saw it. Okay? I don't for a second think that you saw some bears and just misidentified them. Okay. If you did, then you're master in, what'd you call
deception?
It? No.
I need to be working for the government again.
Yeah. But I mean, if you're, the stuff that allows you, you know, that you're going out teaching tracking classes and following salamanders, along their mating route, you should give back whatever certificate they gave to you then, if you can't tell the difference between a bear and a Bigfoot from
40 yards away. I agree with that. Yeah.
You know, I mean, just the fact that you got that, there's a group of people that would go out in the middle of the night and count salamanders is crazy.
Oh yeah, man, you should hang out with some of those folks. You'd love them there.
I don't know. That just like, that blows my, that almost blows my mind more than you having a Bigfoot experience. That
you got a bunch of amphibian geeks showing up out here in droves, sometimes like upwards of like 15 or 20 people, and they're all spatting off Latin terminology.
Oh my gosh. That would be,
sounds like you're summoning a demon.
I mean, the respect for the passion and the drive to do something so specific like that is, I mean, I can't, it's, yeah, it's, I have it. But I mean, to me, on the other hand, it's like, I couldn't tell one salamander from the next, you know, holy smokes. But there again, somebody that's going out and studying nature like that and
can identify things that specifically in the minor differences in them, those are the kind of eyewitness people that how can you question what they're seeing?
Really,
because
they're really want those eyewitnesses.
Yeah, their eye for detail and taking notes on stuff is unprecedented in nature, you know, where the average person wouldn't even pay, you know, any attention to it. They'd be like, yeah, it's maybe a toad. Maybe it's a frog. I don't know. Is it, you know, I don't know. Yeah. Is it a lizard or is this, yeah. I mean, I probably have only ever seen two salamanders in my life that weren't in a, you know, confined area like a zoo or some kind of exhibit. So, you know, so the average person probably doesn't even have a clue, you know. So yeah, those type of people out there being eyewitnesses turn it up a notch for me, for sure. Even if they didn't have a sighting, they know what's going on out there because they're out there in nature all the time. I mean, it'd be like somebody doing one of my streets on my mail route and not having a dog bark at them, and they'd be like, look, no, there's no dogs barking. Well, no, you only went down the street once. Go down the street every day, time and time again, and you're going to experience different things, and you're going to get used to, you know, where things are, when they happen, how they happen, and you're just going to, you know, anticipate some things too. So yeah, yeah, that kind of eyewitness I really like, because you guys all have eyes for detail. And then speaking of eyes for detail, it kind of leads us into what you do at Wild and Weird West Virginia, as far as like the little statues and stuff like that. You want to tell everybody how your experiences and stuff led into that?
Yeah, sure. So we eventually everything kind of came into this point where we were going to these different venues and we were seeing people, meeting people and whatnot. And I had a background in as a chef where, you know, I was taught how to carve and sculpt in ice and fruit and all kinds of other stuff.
I thought you were going to say roast beef. I was gonna say,
oh, yeah. You know, I carve and sculpt up some of those too. Don't worry. It translated into clay very well. So we started making little sculptures and statues, and Ron made some sculptures, and mostly he does painting and jewelry and whatnot, but it's all related to witness interpretation and what people have seen in the field, and also making some really cool collectibles at the same time. You know, we make keychains, and everything's handmade by us. None of it's purchased and brought in. It's all made by us. Art prints, paintings, keychains, necklaces, statues, miniature sculpts, a whole line of UFO scale replica models that you can get. And Giorgio Tsoukalos actually has all of our UFOs up to date currently. We've got a few more we got to get out to him, but yeah, we make some really fun stuff, man. And we sell it, and it funds the research side of what we do. So that way we're not taking as much of a hit out of pocket. And it's a good time. We get to meet all kinds of fantastic people. Because of all this, we now host a podcast called Wild and Weird Radio, where people can listen to us and come on and join us. We also host multiple events every year. We have a couple Bigfoot workshops a year where people can come out and we do a full intensive on field work and how to track, how to make your own plaster casts, how to use equipment in the field, what equipment you want in the field versus what you don't want in the field, how to distinguish animal calls. And then at the end of the day, we take everybody out into the field, into a research area that we've kind of set up, and we actually make observations. And 99.9% of the time, nothing happens. We hear some weird animals, and that's about it. But you get some high strangeness that might occur, or you actually can have some kind of encounter with an auditory encounter. We had one of the folks that came to our workshop last year had actually had a visual encounter the night before in the area that we did the workshop, and was freaked out. It was great. And, because they had come to the area and they were camping in the area. So then we also host Wild and Weird Con, which is a big yearly event. And we've got the Woodbugger Jamboree, which is a local community event, free to the public to come and hang out. And it's turned into this whole big thing. And we really love that we can give back to the community in that respect. Because we can make stuff they can put on their shelves and they can help us with research. And then we bring in researchers from around the United States to come in and help teach them how to do it, or just to sit and listen to them. It's a great time. We have a blast with it.
Well, that's all. I mean, that's awesome that you are getting to do something you're so passionate about and sort of make a living at it too. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I think that's, everybody knows that's the definition of never working a day in your life is getting paid to do something you love, you know.
Absolutely.
And even though it's, you know, not, I don't think the Bigfoot phenomena is making anybody rich. It might make some people rich. It's not making us rich, but
right. But, yes.
But it's, but it is something that a lot of people love, and a lot of people, you know, I'm sure would appreciate the cool stuff that you guys do. So hopefully everybody listening will go yeah. Check out the Wild and Weird West Virginia. You got a website for that?
You can find us at wildandweirdwv.com. We actually just launched a forum that everybody can come and hang out and chat to. There, it's all right there attached to the website. The shop is there. The podcast feed is there. Or you can find us any podcast stuff out there, whatever your favorite subscription base is. You just, you know, look us up. We're there.
Cool. I hope everybody goes and at least goes and checks out the store. And
yeah,
I'm sure they can find something. I looked at some. I'm digging the Mothman thing. I think we're going to promote the little Mothman character that you had with the big red eyes.
Oh,
for Mothman. I said to my social media person, we're gonna do it on Mothman Monday.
So I'll send you some better photos.
Okay. Yeah. Send me something. We'll put that up. And because I tell you, people love the Mothman.
They do.
People love Mothman.
Is Mothman's a West Virginia staple.
I don't trust him, but people love him. I'm just gonna put that out there. Joe, I appreciate you coming on and sharing your experience and telling us a couple other experiences. And I hope everybody goes and checks out your website and goes and checks you guys out on Wild and Weird Radio, because it sounds like you probably have a lot of good discussions on there about stuff going on in West Virginia and everywhere else.
Yeah, it's a good time, man. And thanks for having me on. I've loved it. If you ever want to do something again, just let me know.
Definitely. I like it when somebody says, "Do you want to hear something really weird?" I mean, that's really
plenty of that.
That really ups the game right there. I love it. So yeah, we'll definitely stay in touch, because I can't wait to hear some more great stories from West Virginia. Because like I said, goes without saying, West Virginia is wild and weird for sure. So,
absolutely.
Ohio's not far behind, though.
You very much are not. We're actually,
I can't be honest.
If any of your listeners are from Ohio, we're going to be at the Ohio Bigfoot Conference there at the end of this month.
Oh, yeah. We, you know, it unfortunately for me, it's our travel basketball season.
And, oh, yeah.
I run a, you know, girls AAU basketball group here, and we're always playing through that weekend. So I don't even get to go and just hang out and see anybody. So it's better off. Because it's because sometimes coaching girls basketball is even crazier than
no doubt
Bigfoot and Mothman.
No doubt.
And I'm not saying that they're monsters. Do not put words in my mouth. I'm just saying that sometimes it's great. Now, parents, on the other hand, sometimes they're monsters. But there you go. But all right, Joe. Well, I appreciate it. And looking forward to the next thing.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me on. Stay wild and weird, everybody.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of the From the Shadows podcast. Until next time, never shy away from the darkness or what may be lurking in the shadows. We are out.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.